The Hornet loomed out of the darkness, and everyone in Research Vessel Petrol's control room whooped with joy. The unmanned submersible had dropped practically right on top of the old ship on the first try. Paul Allen smiled. This was his 15th World War II wreck discovery, and one of his most anticipated. The Petrel had parked itself directly over the wreck of the World War II era lost aircraft carrier USS Hornet in the Solomon Sea. It was February 2019, which was summer in this hemisphere. The weather was warm and sunny and tropical, with only a slight chop on the dark waters. Paul Allen had co-founded Microsoft with Bill Gates, and ever since had used his tens of billions of dollars to do basically whatever the heck he wanted, including a hobby totally out of the reach to all but the awesomely eccentric billionaire, hunting for old World War II shipwrecks. Allen had already discovered the USS Lexington and the USS Indianapolis, as well as the Japanese super battleship Musashi, but the long-lost Hornet was his crown jewel. But for the long-lost ship, CV-8 was pretty much right where she had last been seen on October 27th, 1942, just about 3.3 miles straight down. The ship was resting upright on the ocean floor, 17,500 feet deep. It was mostly intact, although the bridge tower had broken off and was laying next to the ship. Mostly intact SBD Dauntless dive bombers, TBD Devastator torpedo bombers, and F-4F Wildcat fighters lay scattered around the seabed in concentric circles around the wreck. Allen couldn't believe how well-preserved the ship and the surrounding wreckage was when he found it. It had been there for more than 77 years, yet the wooden flight deck was still intact, minus the bomb damage. The anti-aircraft guns were still pointing up, as if still fending off Japanese Val bombers. This is the U.S. Naval History Podcast, and this episode tells the story of the USS Hornet, told by me, and by the men who served aboard her, in the ship's less than 2 years of service, before sinking below the waves, lost for 77 more years. It's the story of thousands of men, and I am pulling on a few of those stories, pilots, aircrew, aircraft maintainers, and ship's company, to tell a brief history of one of the most famous American aircraft carriers of the first year of the war in the Pacific. She was the carrier to launch the Doolittle raid against Japan. She fought at Midway and at Guadalcanal. Her plane sunk half the Japanese carrier fleet, and she had been hit more than 24 times. But less than 2 years before sinking, the USS Hornet launched as the last true Yorktown-class carrier in December of 1940 from Newport News, Virginia, just a year before Pearl Harbor. She was 825 feet long and had a crew of more than 2,200 after adding the air crew to fly and maintain her aircraft. The Hornet was originally planned to be attached to the Atlantic Fleet, but the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941 changed that. From her home base in Norfolk, the Hornet was almost immediately scheduled as the tip of the spear for the country's first counterstrike against the Empire of Japan. But the operation was so secret that even her skipper, Captain Mark Michener, was unaware of what was planned for his ship, although he started to get a pretty good idea when 16 large Army twin-engine B-25 bombers were loaded by crane onto the deck of the ship. This type of operation had never been attempted before, and it was led by the soon-to-be-famous Lieutenant Colonel James Doolittle. Aboard the carrier, a sealed envelope was handed to Captain Michener by special courier as he watched the big land-based bombers being loaded up. The Hornet was to join Task Force 16, commanded by Admiral Halsey and made up of her sister carrier, the USS Enterprise, three heavy cruisers, one light cruiser, and eight destroyers for protection. Two refueling tankers were tasked to join the task force for the long trip across the Pacific as they sailed past Hawaii and towards Japan. Their mission? To launch the B-25s off the coast of Japan. Here's the raid's commander, James Doolittle, describing the mission objectives 38 years later.
It had three real purposes. One purpose was to give the folks at home the first good news that we had had in World War II. It caused the Japanese to question their warlords. And from a tactical point of view, it caused the retention of aircraft in Japan for the defense of the home islands when we had no intentions of hitting them again seriously in the near future. Those airplanes would have been much more effective in the South Pacific where the war was going on.
This would be a one-way trip. The Army bombers had no tailhooks to land back on the carrier's deck and were flying into the heart of enemy territory. The idea was that the bombers would take off hundreds of miles east of Japan and then hit Tokyo and continue flying east to land at friendly bases in China. As soon as the Doolittle Raiders launched from the flight deck, the plan for the task force was to turn around and as quickly as possible sail for safety once the bombers were airborne. For the seas before Midway were decidedly Japanese. The Japanese six carriers, the Kido Butai, were the strongest fleet ever assembled, and it was still out there, at full strength, and just proven itself in the most successful naval campaign in world history, conquering almost the entire Western Pacific in a matter of weeks. Malaya, the Philippines, Guam, Wake, and dozens of other smaller yet important island chains had all fallen, almost without loss. The U.S. Pacific Fleet and the British Fleet at Singapore were almost destroyed. Hong Kong and Singapore, the two bastions of British power in Asia, had fallen. And so this raid was meant to be just that, a raid, not a slugfest with a clearly superior Japanese fleet. But as you just heard from the man himself, striking back at Japan would send a shock to the Japanese public and a message to the world, the message that America can and would strike back. Here's General Doolittle again.
If we were intercepted by Japanese surface or aircraft, our aircraft would immediately leave the decks. If they were within range of Tokyo, they would go ahead and bomb Tokyo, even though they would run out of gasoline shortly thereafter. That was the worst thing we could think of.
And early in the morning of April 18th, 1942, hours and more than 100 miles east of where Doolittle's raiders planned to launch from, the task force was spotted by a Japanese patrol boat while still 600 miles from Japan. Although the Enterprise's fighters and the USS Nashville eventually did sink the picket boat, the Japanese had still managed to get a message out. Doolittle and Michener conferred and realized that they had no choice. They had to launch now or risk the mighty Imperial Japanese Navy bearing down on them. Doolittle and his 130 volunteers boarded their big bombers, which were filled to the brim with extra fuel. Here's Doolittle Raider flight engineer Edward Saylor's recollection of the pre-flight fuel preparations, which included jury-rigged extra fuel tanks and extra 5-gallon cans stored at the crew's feet for the long-range bombing run that would push the bombers to the limits of their range.
The 18th of April, run into a Japanese picket ship out there. And we were afraid that they had radioed to Japan that the task force out there. So we had to take off immediately. And we found out later that the Japanese picket ship, before it was sunk, had radioed to Japan that there was a task force there. But the Japanese knew there was no U.S. aircraft off a carrier could fly that far and return the carrier, so they weren't prepared for us. They took all the weight off the airplane we possibly could. The bottom turret was removed because we would be flying so low that no enemy fighter could get underneath of us. And they put a 60-gallon tank in where that bottom turret was. In the bomb bay, in the top of the bomb bay, they also put a tank that held over 100 gallons of gasoline. We still had room for 400 or 500-pound bombs. There's a crawlway between the top of the bomb bay and the top of the airplane, just enough room to crawl through there. They put a collapsible rubber tank in there, held way over 100 gallons, and they used the gasoline out of there after we left Japan. And they transferred all the gasoline out of that tank. Then I was able to roll that tank to one side, so then I could crawl through there to get up to the front of the airplane. Before I got up in the airplane, they handed me a dozen 5-gallon cans of gasoline so that they used the gasoline out of the turret tank first, and then I was able to dump those cans of gasoline into the turret tank and used the crash axe to cut a hole in each end of those empty cans, threw them out the window.
Bombs were loaded, and amid the howling winds and a flight deck violently pitching up and down in the North Pacific chop, the bombers timed their launch for the upswing of the Hornet's bow and prepared to take off. Doolittle was the first plane to go. He revved the engine to full power and released the brakes. The lumbering bomber slowly inched down the deck. Its speed picked up faster and faster. The end of the Hornet's flight deck grew large in the windshield. Doolittle's B-25 rolled off the end of the deck and dropped out of view below the carrier's deck for heart-stopping seconds before the overloaded plane roared up into view and began to climb into the sky. The next bomber went, and then the next. It took just over an hour for all 16 planes to get airborne, but they all made it. The USS Hornet and Task Force 16 turned to the southeast and fired their engines to full speed to get out of there. Edward Sailor takes it over again from here.
We took off in very rough weather, but when we reached Japan, the weather cleared up, sun was shining, and just a beautiful day. It was Saturday, right about noon, and there were quite a few people on the beach, and as we went overhead, they were waving to us. We were flying so low, I could see the expressions on their faces. They were cheering, but we were over their heads and gone before they could see the Army Air Corps insignia on the bottom of the right wing and on both sides of the airplane. Of course, we were flying about 50 feet off the ground. Between the coast then and before we reached Tokyo, formation of six airplanes met us, but we were flying so low, I'm sure they didn't see us. They just kept on going the direction they were going. That's the only other enemy plane that we saw. As we approached Tokyo, then we had to climb to 1,500 feet. So when our bombs went off, they wouldn't blow us out of the air. And there was quite a bit of anti-aircraft fire over the city when we reached there, but it wasn't accurate. Our target was this Nippon Steel factory in Tokyo. We dropped our four bombs on that and then headed for Tokyo Bay and got out of there as soon as we could. And then we followed the coast of Japan, not over land, but over the ocean, all the way to the southern tip of Japan, and then turned west to China.
But bombing Japan was just the beginning of the mission. Escaping the Japanese and getting home was a whole nother story.
Well, it was nearly dark and raining, and the pilot spotted a strip of beach that he thought he could set the airplane down on, but I think he misjudged the distance because it was pretty dark. And so we hit the water with our wheel down, immediately turned us upside down. The other four of the crew were thrown out through the nose of the airplane. I was in the back. I was knocked unconscious for a while. Finally realized that there was water coming in what I thought was the bottom of the airplane. So I tried to get out there, but then realized it was upside down and the plexiglass on the turret had shattered, so that's where water was coming in. So I was able to work my way back to the bottom escape hatch and open that and get out on the bottom of the airplane. And I stepped off the tail of the airplane then. It was, water was about waist deep. By that time, the other four of the crew had gotten up onto the beach. The first thing we saw was a few people up on the bank there, and they must have heard the crash because they come down from their couple of buildings there. So they tried to help us to get up on the bank and away from the airplane. So we stayed there overnight, and the pilot had a deep gash in his leg and a gash in his arm, and the co-pilot had a deep gash in his left arm, The navigator was kneeling between the pilot and co-pilot's armor-plated seats when he went out. The bombardier must have gone out through the nose of the airplane because the imprint of the bracing on a plexiglass nose was sort of imprinted on the top of his head, and he was bleeding profusely. They got us up to there, and I had one large bandage in my first aid kit, and I used that to try to close the cut on a pilot's leg. And then we had to use probably handkerchiefs and I don't know what else, maybe undershirts to try and bind up the gashes on the other people's heads. About 11 o'clock, and the guerrilla leader on the island there picks up some stretchers, some pallets, so they could carry them, the other four, because they couldn't walk then. And we left there at 11 o'clock that morning, and we found out later, about 3 o'clock, there were a company of Japanese soldiers landed right on that spot and came looking for us. But we'd already started across the island, so they never caught up to us. It took us most of the night and most of the next day to get across that island. It was a pretty good-sized island. And then the evening of the second day, we finally reached free territory in China, a small city there on the coast of Haiyu. And there we were met by a Chinese doctor that had come from a city of Linhai that day to help us. So then that was the first medical attention we'd had for 2 days. By that time, gangrene had set in a pilot's leg, so he eventually had to have it amputated at that hospital in China. The third day, then, we had to travel 25 miles to get to that hospital, but just walking and being carried. And the Chinese had blown up all the roads along the coast to slow the advance of the Japanese, so there were just trails through the rice paddies to get there. We were there 3 days, and a crew number 15 had made a good water landing out farther from the coast, so they got them, brought them to the island that we were on, and I went on with the other four of crew number 15. Worked our way inland. It took us, we traveled by sedan chair and every mode of transportation you could think of. Finally got the city of Hanyang. It's a huge city on the Yangtze River. And there, an airplane was supposed to come in from Chongqing to pick us up. The fourth morning, the airplane came in from Chongqing to pick us up. We finally reached Chongqing a month after Christ. So there, Madame Chiang Kai-shek had a banquet for us. We met the Generalissimo. He could not speak English or understand it, but she could because she went to school here in the United States. We were there about 3 days in Chongqing and then flew to Kunming to refuel. And that's where the AVG, the American Volunteer Group, was stationed, and flew over the hump to Calcutta. It was during the dry season and hazy and dusty, and we overshot Calcutta and landed in a big plowed field. And Indians coming from all directions ran out there, the natives, to see what was the matter. We finally talked to one old man. He said told us where Calcutta was, which direction, so we took off and then landed at the airport at Calcutta. I was there for 10 days and waiting for orders. I was there the last 10 days of May of 42, and then went to New Delhi by train and then to Karachi by flew there. And there I received my orders to come back to the United States.
So as you heard firsthand, even with every gallon of fuel the planes could carry, 15 out of the 16 bombers ran out of fuel before reaching the secretly constructed airfields in eastern China. Two planes went down in the Sea of Japan, and their crews were lost. 13 of the crews bailed out over China or on the coastline of China, with 8 men eventually being captured by the Japanese. 3 of those men would go on to be executed, and the remaining 5 would remain Japanese prisoners until August of 1945. One of the bombers made it to Vladivostok in Soviet Russia, where the crew were interred, since the USSR was not at war with Japan, nor were they particularly interested in provoking conflict with the Japanese, given that the war in Europe had only just begun to swing in their favor. However, a convenient escape would later be arranged for the American pilots, who were welcomed home as heroes. Doolittle himself met up with the Chinese resistance and made his way back to friendly lines. He would end up commanding the U.S. Air Forces in Europe a year later. 50 Japanese were killed in the attack, and the damage was light, but the entire Empire of Japan was shocked. The safety of the emperor was no longer assured, and the navy, which had guaranteed the homeland's impregnability from attack, was humiliated. The Japanese launched Operation Saigo in May of 1942 to punish the Chinese and to push them away from the East Coast to prevent any American planes from staging a repeat attack. Using extreme brutality and biological warfare, the Japanese butchered around 250,000 Chinese civilians in retaliation for the raid. The USS Hornet was on the front page of newspapers around the world after the Doolittle raid. The Navy made a commemorative film, and her crew were toasted as absolute heroes. But the situation in the Pacific was too dire to allow the crew any rest. The USS Yorktown and the USS Lexington had run into the main Japanese carrier fleet at the Coral Sea, and the Hornet was sent south to aid them. The battle was over before she got there, with the USS Lexington sunk while the Yorktown suffered extensive battle damage. And that left the Hornet as one of the few carriers left in operational condition in the Pacific. The Hornet's air wing launched several air raids against Japanese-held islands and destroyed a couple airfields and sunk a couple of transport ships and destroyers before heading back to Pearl Harbor. From Pearl Harbor, the Hornet joined the Enterprise and the still-damaged Yorktown, which was literally being welded back together as she sailed into battle, for a daring new mission: to ambush the Japanese fleet off Midway. You see, the Japanese had decided to sink the American carriers once and for all. The Doolittle raid and the Battle of Coral Sea had shaken the Japanese high command and proven the danger that the small U.S. carrier fleet still represented. The Japanese plan devoted 4 precious carriers to a surprise raid on the island of Midway, with the goal of luring the unprepared American carriers out of Pearl Harbor for a decisive battle where they would be at a disadvantage. But U.S. intelligence had broken the Japanese naval codes, and we knew exactly what they had planned. And so naval leadership sent the 3 remaining carriers north from Pearl Harbor to Midway to await the Japanese carriers in a counter-ambush. The American carriers would ambush the ambushers. On June 4th, 1942, Japanese carrier-based airplanes began bombing the tiny island of Midway. Shortly after, U.S. spotter planes located the Japanese fleet. Yorktown, Enterprise, and Hornet launched their planes. The first wave consisted of TBD Devastator torpedo bombers. These were slow, outdated, and lumbering planes, and they were sent unsupported by fighter cover and using tactics that hadn't yet proven their worthlessness. These planes found the Japanese fleet and swooped low over the waves to drop their torpedoes at close range. Japanese Mitsubishi A6M-0 fighters dived on the Devastators from above and slaughtered the torpedo bomber wave almost to a plane. And here's David Allen Payne, an aviation machinist mate who knew and worked with many of the pilots who fought and died at Midway, taking up the story.
And old John Walden, he taxied up to the takeoff spot in them old TBDs. They were a slow airplane. And he'd have his head hung out behind the windshield, and he'd be working his mouth like that, and we nicknamed him Smiling Jack. And on that morning, he told the boys he had them all to write a letter home to their folks. He knowed it was going to be a one-way trip, because them Zeros eat them up as slow as they was. And our dive bombers is all over the fleet, and the fighters was with them, so they didn't have no fighter protection. And the Zeros shot every one of them down. And there was three men to the plane, pilot, radioman, and a rear seat gunner. And there's 15 of them, and every one of them got shot down. And Ensign Gay was in the last one, and he made a run, and he launched his torpedo. And he flew over this here Jap carrier, and they shot him down, and he landed in the water, and he got his life preserver and got under it and watched the battle from it. And he said there's a Jap destroyer come by him, and there's a pointing at him, seen him, and he thought they was going to come back and kill him. But he floated in the days about 3 days in the water with that life raft, and a PBY, a Navy patrol boat, picked him up. And he was a sole survivor now. And I'd say old John Waldron, Smiling Jack, he knew that was going to be a one-way trip because he was experienced. He was a lieutenant commander. And them boys, he told them, follow him and get a hit if you can. But we lost all of them. And in the meantime, our dive bombers from the three carriers was unloading and sunk four of their Jap carriers. So that said that was a turning point of the Pacific War, Midway.
And I have to say that I have listened to a lot of oral histories over the years making this podcast, but that the recollections of the Hornet's crew about Midway are somewhat unique in that many, many, many of them feature, even decades later, you can just hear it in their voices, a level of vitriol and disgust about this failed torpedo run, and I've rarely heard that in other oral histories of World War II. And I think that just speaks to the hard choices of war that ultimately led to an undefended wave of torpedo bombers going against the Japanese carriers. The Devastator was woefully outclassed by 1942, but the SBD Dauntless dive bombers were a different matter. And as you heard John talking about, as the Devastators were being shot down by the swooping Zeros, the Zeros lost all their altitude. And so in a grim, battered, tarnished silver lining of war, that sacrifice was made worth it 100 times over, as several flight of Dauntless dive bombers appeared high in the sky over the Japanese fleet through what was essentially just dumb luck at the perfect time, because the Zeros had all come down to shoot the torpedo bombers that were just a couple feet off the water, meaning that they couldn't combat the dive bombers from below. You have to do that from above. And so these American dive bombers just rolled over and began their screaming dives, and each section of dive bombers aimed for a different Japanese carrier, with the Japanese Zeros totally out of place to intercept and defend. They could freely release their bombs only a couple hundred meters above the ships. It was impossible to miss. And so in very rapid succession, the Japanese carriers Akagi, Hiru, Kaga, and Soryu, the four big carriers of Japan's fleet, were sent blazing from dive bomber hits. Several destroyers and Japanese heavy cruiser were also hit and on fire. And in those couple of minutes, the war changed. By late afternoon, the tide of the war had totally shifted in the Pacific. The Imperial Japanese Navy had lost the bulk of its carriers and the 248 aircraft, which had nowhere to land after the carriers were sunk. During the battle, the Japanese raids managed to hit and to sink the USS Yorktown, but the Hornet, her Wildcat fighters managed to fight off several waves of Japanese bombers. Despite being straddled by falling bombs, the Hornet suffered almost no battle damage. But still, even after Midway, there wasn't much chance to rest. The Marines were conducting a major operation in the Solomon Islands to protect Australia from Japanese invasion, and the Hornet was needed there. So the background to this is that by October of 1942, the United States and Japan had been locked in a battle of attrition on and around the island of Guadalcanal for more than 2 months. The 1st Marine Division, and now elements of the Army's 164th Infantry Regiment, still retained full control of the priceless Henderson Field, that's an airfield at the center of the island, which served as the anchor for U.S. presence on Guadalcanal. The 2 months of fighting on the island had whittled the Japanese strength on the island down, especially after the blistering defeats at Tenaru in August and then on Edson's Ridge in September. And yet the Japanese were still as determined as ever to eliminate that American presence ashore. And so the Japanese were generally better night fighters, and during the daytime, they couldn't really contest American air power because we had Henderson Field, plus we had superior air power in the region. But at night, they could make that dash and essentially deliver troops and supplies to Guadalcanal and then get out of that U.S. air coverage zone by the time the sun rose. And so they were doing this via destroyer, via submarine. The Japanese were slowly bringing those soldiers and those supplies ashore at night for another massive assault on Henderson Field. This time, though, the assault would be coordinated alongside a strong Imperial Japanese naval offensive designed to either sink or drive away the American carriers around Guadalcanal once and for all, and complement that land assault to take place out from under the withering air attack that they had all failed against before. And so, just like at Midway, the Japanese codes had been broken, and American intelligence was well aware of Japanese plans for another assault on Guadalcanal towards the end of October. Luckily for us, after Midway, the balance of naval forces in the Pacific were balanced, at least, right? Maybe even a slight edge to the United States. But that still meant that any major concentration of Japanese forces still required a major American defensive effort. And so Admiral Halsey began to prepare by sending essentially whatever forces he could muster to defend the island. The very battered carrier Enterprise was still recovering and repairing the damage that she had suffered in the Eastern Solomons, and she deployed with a brand new air group and was making her way to the area following those slapdash repairs at Pearl Harbor. So the Enterprise, together with the Hornet and the two carriers' 21 escort ships, Admiral Halsey had to hope that that was enough to stop the Japanese assault from driving off the naval presence and then trapping tens of thousands of Marines on Guadalcanal as the Japanese fleet assembled the best of what they had left after Midway to strike against the island. Four Japanese carriers and their 36 escorts began to bear down on the island of Guadalcanal. On shore, the Japanese launched yet another bonsai charge, a human wave attack against the perimeter of Henderson Field on the night of October 23rd. And the Japanese were just slaughtered. But the army was unwilling to lose face to the Navy because there was an extremely intense inter-service rivalry between the Japanese Navy and the Army. And they essentially determined that they were going to try again, even though the odds were now utterly overwhelmingly against them. But because they didn't want to lose face, the Japanese army radioed to the fleet that they had achieved victory. And so the Japanese fleet moved in and began its assigned mission to support the victorious army by sweeping the seas clear of the American fleet to give time for the army to finish off the straggler Americans on the islands before reinforcements could arrive and turn the tide of the battle back to a stalemate. And so at 6:45 a.m. on October 26th, American scout planes located the main body of the Japanese fleet, which consisted of the carriers Shokaku and Tsuikaku. Less than 15 minutes later, the Japanese scouts also managed to locate the Hornets task force, and both fleets began to ready their air groups and launch their aircraft. In the air early that morning, flying with the Hornets Bombing Squadron 8, that's VB-8, was Lieutenant Junior Grade Clayton Fisher. Fisher's formation was packing 1,000-pound bombs painted with the names of enemy carriers that they hoped to land them on, and was escorted by only four F-4F Wildcats. Knowing full well that the Japanese carriers would be heavily protected by combat air patrols, that's defensive fighters, effectively, Lieutenant Fisher had a bad feeling about going in with that lack of escort. Here is Pilot Clayton Fisher's remembrance of that mission in 2019, some 77 years after the battle.
So finally, they decided to launch us, and as we're coming out of the ready room before they launched, said, you guys are going to get four fighters for protection. I was in a flight of 16 VB-8 and VS-8 pilots. And I really thought I was on a suicide mission. I think we all did. I mean, you know, four fighters, and they couldn't, we knew they couldn't handle the Zeros. I think we probably got about 6,000 to 8,000 feet, and my section leader gave me kind of a silly look and pointed up, and I looked up, and here's this beautiful big flight of dive bombers and Japanese planes, Zeros up above. They're all silver, beautiful, tight formation, big red meatballs, and they went over the top of us. Well, in the meantime, we started picking up these Zeros. We were all getting hit. I think most of the gunners got hit. And of that flight, we had no fighter protection, and we still got four hits, I think.
As you can hear, Clayton's plane was hit before it reached its target. Leaking hydraulic fluid and without any air brakes, he overshot his target on the dive bombing run. But the rest of his flight managed to score 1,000-pound bomb hits on the carrier Shikaku, holding her flight deck and rendering her useless for the remainder of the battle. As his SDB was leaking hydraulic fluid, making it harder and harder to control, Clayton flew to the nearest cloud for cover. But before he could safely reach the cloud, his retreating SDB was attacked again by an enemy Zero.
Well, I found myself on a one-on-one. Finally, he hit me with a 20-millimeter that exploded in the transmitter behind the armor plate. The concussion in a closed cockpit, it just felt like I got hit over the head with something and got a real hot, like felt like I had a hot rod go through my right shoulder. I mean, and I was stunned. I mean, I just, all the fight went out of me. I couldn't move. And I finally got my senses. Well, all of a sudden, this guy's flying wing on me.
As Clay regained his senses, he pulled his airplane up, looked over, and realized that the enemy plane was flying wing on him, waiting for him to go down. Clay's gunner, Ferguson, wheeled his twin 30-caliber machine guns over and unleashed a long blast at the Zero. The return fire chased the enemy pilot off and left Fisher and Ferguson to fend for themselves all the way back to the Hornet. As the wounded plane reached the American task force, it became clear that they would not be able to land aboard the carrier. The Hornet had sustained heavy damage from the enemy airstrike that had passed over Fisher earlier that morning. That's one that he was talking about in that first clip that went straight past him as they went out to strike the Japanese carrier.
Well, I finally picked up the Hornet and she was dead in the water, and it really shocked me. I mean, God, she was foam all over the flight deck, looking yellow foam and listing pretty bad. Well, then I could see the Enterprise way in the distance, and as I got closer to it, it looked like a bunch of hornet's nests. There was planes all over the place trying to get aboard, and I knew I couldn't get aboard without flap. So as soon as I got as low as I could, and as soon as the plane started to shake, I cut the throttle, and I hit. Well, the Juno came over next to us, and they had a cargo net over the side. They did that where they're going to pick up people abandoned ship like the Hornet. They had rigged to do this. And as soon as they started going by us, they threw lines over. And I grabbed the first line I caught, and I wrapped it around my wrist. They got a line around me, and they jerked me up like a plumb bomb. I'm on the main deck, so they hauled us down into below the third turret on the bow. And they had a little kind of like a sick bay down there, and there was a sailor down there with a leg in a cast and so on.
With his plane ditched in the water and picked up by the anti-aircraft cruiser Juno, Clay Fisher's Santa Cruz ordeal was finally over. But his carrier's ordeal was not. Lieutenant Junior Grade Fisher's bad luck accepted. The American attack was a success. At the cost of a dozen aircraft shot down by screening anti-aircraft and enemy combat air patrol fighters, the Hornet and the Enterprise's strike packages found their marks. Early in the morning, the Japanese mini-carrier Zuiho's flight deck was taken out of commission for the battle by two well-placed dive bombing runs. And a few hours later, the flight carrier Shokaku was hit by three, not four as Clay said, 1,000-pound armor-piercing bombs, crippling her and setting her afire. But the Japanese strikes also struck home. At the same time as the Shikaku was being attacked, more than 100 Japanese planes were converging on the Hornet and the Enterprise. American radar technology and the diffusion of that technology throughout the fleet was much farther along than Japanese radar technology and its diffusion throughout the Japanese fleet. And so that gave the Americans an advantage, and specifically it allowed American radar to detect the inbound Japanese strike pretty far ahead of time, just after 9 a.m. The task force carriers split and began to take evasive maneuvering. At 10 a.m., the American Defensive Combat Air Patrol fighters made contact with the Japanese attackers. tangling with the escorting Zeros while trying to get the slow, vulnerable dive and torpedo bombers, which posed that mortal threat to the American carriers. The Enterprise managed to take cover under a passing rain squall, but all that meant was that the full force of the attack was concentrated on the Hornet. About 10 minutes after that Japanese strike group passed Clay Fisher in the air, they came within visual range of the Hornet's task force. And here I'm going to quote from Ian Toll's The Conquering Tide on the Japanese attack. "Stand by for dive bombing attack," warned the Hornet's loudspeakers at 9:09. And down came a long convoy of steeply diving Val dive bombers. Tearing through the sea at 28 knots, the carrier S turned radically and her anti-aircraft guns threw up a dense barrage. But several planes made accurate releases at the near-suicidal altitude of 800 feet. Three 250-kilogram bombs crashed through the Hornet's flight deck in a quick succession and exploded in the lower decks. A damaged Val dived vertically into the island, its pilot apparently determined to trade his life at a chance to destroy the ship's brain center. The burning plane glanced off the stack, sheared through the signal bridge, and crashed into the flight deck amidships. Saturated with burning aviation gasoline, the Hornet's entire superstructure burst into flames. According to Alvin Kiernan, stationed in a repair shack just below the island, quote, "A bright red flame came up like an express train down the passageway, throwing everything and everybody flat." At the same time, low-flying Japanese torpedo planes approached on the starboard and port side simultaneously. They attempted to fly over or around the screening ships to get to the Hornet. One of the South Dakota's 40-millimeter quad mounts destroyed an oncoming Nakajima, that's a Japanese fighter, when it was just 30 yards away, quote, "sawing the wings right off," as a witness recalled. Another enemy plane hopped over the South Dakota and crashed, apparently deliberately, into the port side of the Hornet. Burning wreckage skittered across the flight deck and fell into the number one elevator pit. Two aerial torpedoes slammed into the wounded carrier's starboard side, lifting the entire hull and shaking it violently. Propulsion, fire main pressure, power, and internal communications were all lost, and the Hornet listed 10 degrees to starboard. So all four of those hits occurred in less than 2 minutes. I just cannot imagine how devastating and scary being aboard the Hornet must have been. Heavily damaged and taking on water and a fire, the Hornet began to lose headway and finally came to a stop, dead in the water. Her damage control crews fought the ship's fires courageously. Here's the recollection of Ronald Veltman, a hospital corpsman who was stationed on the Hornet from the day he graduated boot camp in 1940 until the day she was sunk.
"The other bomb went down into a compartment where housed the damage control parties, ammunition hoist. There was 50 men down there. Five walked out. Bomb exploded right down. That's where we lost my corpsman and the doctor in that particular action. So then up where I was in between the flight deck and the hangar deck. It was up there where Flag Clark usually has. So I'm looking around and I got my wounded out up onto the flight deck and went back down to help out fight the fire, but we couldn't get any pressure."
With the help of three escorting destroyers, the Hornet's crew finally got the fires more or less under control, about 40 minutes after the Japanese planes left. As soon as the Hornet was crippled, a second wave attacked the Enterprise, newly exposed after her protective squall moved off. Successive waves of dive and torpedo bombers pummeled the Enterprise for hours, wounding her badly, but not mortally, like the Japanese had with the Hornet. And the Japanese attack, the Big E, as the Enterprise is known, sustained two bomb hits, seriously damaging the ship, and leaving one of her elevators stuck in the up position, which cut her ability to launch and recover aircraft by 50%. Enterprise survived the encounter due to the immense hail of anti-aircraft fire put up by her own gunners and those of her escorts, specifically the battleship South Dakota, and also in no small part due to the heroic shooting of Stanley Vejtasa, callsign Swede, who shot down a still-standing record of 7 enemy aircraft that had lined up to attack the Enterprise, for which he received an incredible 3rd Navy Cross. I'm going to go ahead and read that segment of his award. Quote, "As a great number of enemy dive bombers and torpedo planes launched a vicious attack upon his carrier, Lieutenant Vejtasa unhesitatingly challenged and shot down two Japanese dive bombers, and then gallantly led his patrol into the attack on a group of enemy torpedo planes with such daring aggressiveness that the formation was completely broken, and three of the hostile bombers jettisoned their torpedoes as they fled. Lieutenant Vejtasa personally shot down five of the remaining Japanese planes, making a total of seven enemy aircraft destroyed in a single fight. But despite the heroics of Lieutenant Vejtasa and the rest of the Enterprise's crew, the writing was now on the wall. With the Enterprise badly damaged and the Hornet crippled, the task force had almost no air cover. It was time to retreat. Leaving the burning and drifting Hornet and a few escort ships behind, the rest of the task force began to retreat, hoping to escape before the next relentless wave of Japanese fighters and bombers arrived to deal out more damage. Again, here's Ian Toll describing the Hornet's predicament. Quote, "The Hornet was a blazing, listing, foundering wreck. Her engineering spaces were heavily flooded, and her propulsion was gone. At 12:30, the cruiser Northampton was summoned to tow the ship. A steel cable run from the cruiser to the carrier's anchor chain promptly broke. 2 hours later, another attempt was made, with a 2-inch cable stowed on the Hornet, muscled up onto the bow by a sweaty, back-breaking effort of more than 500 men. Quote, "With a 15-degree list then on the ship, this was pretty difficult," one officer remarked. "There was foam all over the hangar deck, and so it was slippery as hell." The Northampton gradually got the listing giant underway at 3 or 4 knots. But in the ensuing 7 hours, a relentless series of air attacks fell on his ship. When the last torpedo hit the Hornet, at 3:15 p.m., Commander E.P. Crehan was in one of the repair shacks below. Quote, "The deck on the port side seemed to crack open, and the geyser of fuel oil, which quickly gushed forth, reached a depth of 2 feet and swept all personnel in Repair 5 off their feet and flung them headlong down the sloping deck of Repair 5 compartments to the starboard side. Floundering around with the fuel oil, all personnel somehow regained their feet, and a hand chain was formed to the two-way ladder and escape scuttle, leading from the third deck to the second deck. The escorting destroyers drew close and began removing wounded men from the fantail. Pitching and rolling in the waves, the little ships clanged violently against the carrier, and their rigging fouled into the Hornet's catwalk, tearing away their radar and fire control equipment. With the list increased to 25 degrees, posing an imminent danger to capsize, the captain ordered the crew to abandon ship. Most went over the side, either down the knotted lines or simply by swimming from the hangar deck, which was awash along the length of the starboard side. In the water, the swimmers stayed together and kept excellent discipline. One officer was impressed to see 30 men on a small life raft paddling towards a destroyer singing "Sidewalks of New York" at the top of their lungs and badly out of tune. Here's Ronald Veltman, the hospital corpsman who described the attack, describing his abandoned ship experience.
Later on, they said everybody up on the flight deck. I was up on the port bow. Captain gave an order for everybody not ship's company to get off. So the Mustang came alongside, the Russell, Anderson, and took off what they could. Then they told us to go over the side and abandon ship. My buddy, Bill Good, he's dead now. At that time, he says, "I can't swim." I said, "What?" So I said, "Okay, you go down the line first. Grab a hold of one of those 5-inch shell casings. That's buoyancy. When you get down there and lay horizontal in the water, not vertical. Because bombs were exploding around the particular area. And the concussion, if you're vertical, it'll force the water right up your rectum." So he goes down. I says, "All right, lay on your back. I'll hook my toes on your armpits. And I'll use my arms as a paddle." I'm not moving. I said, "What the hell's going on?" He's kicking the wrong way like he was riding a bike. He didn't have his legs straight out. I finally got that straightened out. And the Anderson picked us up.
The Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands, also known as the Battle of the Solomon Sea, would be the Hornet's last. With all surviving crewmen clear of the ship, several American warships attempted to scuttle the Hornet so that she wouldn't fall into Japanese hands. They hit her with more than 30 torpedoes and 200 heavy shells, but she refused to sink. As word of the approaching Japanese heavy surface fleet spread, the Americans left the Hornet to her fate. The remaining ships in the task force pulled away, leaving the derelict Hornet afloat and smoldering. Later that evening, the Japanese administered the coup de grace, sinking the ship with four torpedoes. The ship that launched Doolittle's Tokyo Raiders slipped beneath the waves at around 5:20 p.m. on October 26, 1942. The loss of the Hornet was a hard blow for the American public to take. She was officially stricken from the order of battle in early 1943, but her namesake would live on. One of the new mass-produced Essex-class carriers being rolled out of dockyards, CV-12, was given the proud name, the eighth and so far final ship in the U.S. Navy to bear her name. USS Hornet, CV-12, joined the fleet in 1943 and served throughout the rest of World War II. She then saw action in the Korean and the Vietnam War and was the carrier to recover Neil Armstrong and the Apollo 11 astronauts after the moon landing. She was finally decommissioned in 1970 and now serves as a floating museum. You can visit the USS Hornet Museum in Alameda, California. This concludes this episode of the U.S. Naval History Podcast. It was a lot of work to produce this one. I hope that you have enjoyed listening to it. There's a lot of people and organizations I want to thank, including the many organizations which record these oral interviews of veterans. And you know, for the World War II generation, it's almost too late. Most of those guys are gone by now. But over the past 10 years, there was a big effort by a lot of these organizations to record these oral interviews, and that's still ongoing now with Korean War and Vietnam veterans as well, to get those memories so that people down the line can make podcasts and do academic research like this. I also want to thank Nathan Dreschner and his Battlegrounds Plus Substack, and I'll put a link in the show notes, provide some information for this, and the National World War II Museum as well also provides some good information. So again, I hope you enjoyed it. Please shoot me an email at usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com and help spread the word, tell your friends, family, post it online, whatever, because this truly was a Herculean amount of effort. The show is a one-man operation, and I'd really appreciate that. Thank you again. Until next time, fair winds and following seas. East side, west side, all around the town. The tots sang, ring a rosy, London Bridge is falling down. Boys and girls together, me and Mamie roar. Fantastic.